You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 519. Just like there are vaccines in the world, but you can't get one yet, there's quality in the world, but it ain't gonna happen on this show. Hello and welcome to Punk News Podcast. My name's Adam White, recording for you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on tonight's show, Punk News news editor M. Moore, up in somewhere north of me, Ontario. Hello.
Hello.
How's it going?
Not too bad. Bit cold, other than that.
Which colored zone are you in?
Oh, we just moved. I think we're in yellow. I think.
Yeah, we're yellow.
I don't know.
The rumor is that we're going to be red on Monday, but it's hard to say. I'm just treating life like it's red. So I don't get too disappointed by anything that changes.
That's smart.
And joining us out of the black zone, or some other sinister sounding zone, the deep mauve zone, Mr. John Gentile out of Philadelphia. No, John.
Actually, Adam, it's the annoyed zone, Adam, and I'm derailing already, and here's why. Why must you continually denigrate the podcast? The podcast is an interesting, amusing, on-point, newsworthy show, and I don't know why you continually denigrate it. I don't know. I don't know if you think you're cute or what's the deal.
John, I think you'll know that I do most things because I'm trying to look cute. That's really my motivation. As I careen through life, that's what I look. I look around and I say, "What am I doing? Is it adorable right now?" John, I think that you and the listenership well know that I operate with a severe I don't know what kind of complex it is, but it's one of those complexes where you're pretty sure that the amount of effort that you're doing into something is crap, and you're surprised that you haven't got your comeuppance due to that yet.
I mean, you're saying the podcast is crap just because we don't put that much effort into it.
I'm saying that if I was the listener to a show on which I was on, given the amount of actual prep that I put into the show, I would be writing myself a very stern letter that says, "Shape up, buddy, or get out."
Yeah, see, but that's the beauty of the punk. I really don't listen to that many podcasts, and the reason is because most podcasts are insufferable because they're like, "I'm Jimmy, and I'm Kimmy, and this is the Lord of the Rings podcast, and we talk about Lord of the Rings, yay!" And like, it's all like very scripted and phony. People dig the Punk News Podcast because we're real, and we give it to them like it is. We don't sugarcoat things. We fight, we argue, but we don't argue just to argue. We argue when we have genuine conflicts, and we agree when we genuinely agree. And we're not playing characters. We're just being ourselves, except for M, who was actually played by Luis Sanchez from Spain in a very, very good good method acting, I'd say.
So John, in the spirit of professionalism, here's my gig right now. So there have been past shows, not many, but a few where I've come in to do this show and I've just been like high off my gourd. And, I don't think any M shows, they tend to be Hallie shows only because, coincidence, but there's definitely been times where we've been in the middle of a conversation and I've had that moment where I've stopped and I've gone like, "Oh no," I'm in a bad place right now to be doing this show because I don't really know what's going on. So I'm just going to wing it. So that's not the case tonight. The case tonight is that just before the show, I took a melatonin capsule thing, and I'm not totally sure how I react to those. My wife takes them to help her sleep, and it's not a thing that I normally take, and I don't know how long it takes to kick in, but I took one, so here we are. So
I don't know what melatonin is.
It's one of those chemicals that your body naturally produces, but if you want to just, have fun, you could make it happen unnaturally in your body, and apparently it helps you go to sleep. Now, I don't know how quickly that takes to kick in my system or anything like that. I mean, I just don't know, right? And I certainly don't need this. It's not something that, I don't have trouble sleeping. I'm mostly just taking this as a recreational experiment right now. And I'm not claiming it's hard drugs or anything. It's fucking melatonin, but I still don't know what it's going to do. So, If I get unusually sleepy, like more than my usual Canadian sleepy, get that this is why.
Okay, well, listen, speaking of people that aren't Canadian, I got a rant real quick. So listen, all year long I've been talking about the three C's nonstop: Chumbawamba, Crass, and Cooper, Alice. And I'm sorry, but I'm not sorry, because those are three amazing artists. I'm going to talk about Crass briefly, real quick, and then maybe we'll let it drop for the rest of the year. Meanwhile, the reason is I listened to a ton of Crass this week, because I've been listening to all the reissues. Man, those are beautifully done reissues. Just amazing. They really are the best reissues, tied with the Ramones reissues from the early 2000s. Anyways, Penny Rimbaud recently did a pretty good interview, actually a very good interview, and he was eloquent as always. However, in the interview, he kind of shocked me, because he said, we usually go to some hit, I mean, Dial House is east of London. I forget exactly where it is, but I got the impression that they go to some artsy fartsy food like store or food co-op to get their food that they can't, that they don't grow at Dial House, which I guess would be like, you know, I don't know, oregano, or well, they probably grow oregano. I don't know. Something, they grow most of their food at Dial House, but whatever they don't buy at Dial House, they buy it someplace that's cool and hip nearby.
Bananas.
Well, those places are bananas. Right. There you go. So those places are all like closed up due to COVID or whatever. So Penny Rimbaud's like, well, we've been ordering our food off Amazon. And I'm like, Penny Rimbaud's ordering shit off Amazon? Penny Rimbaud? And then he says, but is it really any different than the small shops we go to? Because one is just a business for profit on a small scale, and one is a business for profit on a giant scale. I don't really see the difference. And I'm thinking, Penny Rimbaud, there is definitely a difference between Amazon, which destroys small businesses, which exploits farm labor, which doesn't pay fair wages, which only widens the gap between the rich and the poor, and a small business which funnels money directly back into the local community. So the point being is I think Penny Rimbaud is great. I respect him a great deal. He was way off on that, and that comment in and of itself underscored why Steve Ignorant is so essential to Crass. Sometimes people like to dismiss Steve Ignorant because he's not the high-level artsy-fartsy academic side, but what Steve Ignorant is he's the realistic, working-class, practical, pragmatic side. Whereas you would not catch Steve Ignorant doing that. He's the guy that actually has been to work and has worked in places. Unlike Penny Rimbaud, who I like Penny Rimbaud a lot, but he's been, you know, in Dial House for the last 60 years, you know, not actually going to work every day. And so that's why he would say something like as insane as that. I am a huge fan of Penny Rimbaud. I respect him a great deal, but he was off on that comment, and it just annoyed me. And I just wanted to point that out.
You know what? That's not actually a totally bonkers sentiment. I mean, like, let me back right up. I don't agree with that sentiment. It is not a unique sentiment.
Oh.
from people that are on the kind of like extreme ends of one end to the other of the political spectrum. I just, only because I've seen it recently, because there's a guy I know, I don't know him actually, there's a person I am, you know, Twitter acquaintances with, let's say, and you know, he's run extremely leftist, to the point of like, it may even be like a communist kind of like a podcast and publication sort of like in his part of the world, and is one of these people that like is usually speaking in a mix of like heavy internet snark, but also like super 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 on the left leftism, and it's a mix of like those two things. And I've seen him come out and say more than a few times, to the point where I'm pretty sure it's a sincere sentiment on his part, that the fetishization of small business is a completely crazy and perverse thing. If you are someone that exists like on the communist end of the left, and that, you know, if you're against Amazon, then yeah, you should be against, you know, all of the for-profit businesses. Who gives a shit? You should be against all of it, right? I don't agree with this at all. But I think you and me, John, we're both the children of small business owners. So I think maybe we might be a little, a little colored in this, because at a certain point you look at it and you go like, my dad is not the problem. Right. But, you know, so I don't agree with Penny or anything like that, but I've seen that argument come from certain stripes, and it has always struck me as sort of unrealistic.
Adam, you know, when I was in college, I really respected professors, and the older I get, the less respect I have for the average professor. Some professors I respect the same amount, but the older I get, I'm like, this guy is a jackass and has never been in the real world ever. Do you feel that?
I mean, I do. I totally get the sentiment, but my as someone that went to school for all of the for like computer science and stuff like that, like a lot of my professors were either like industry dicks that somehow ended up back in education, or like math people. Like, I didn't have a lot of like like patches on their shoulders, liberal arts professors type people.
Fair.
Like, I didn't have that many dreamers. Or,
speaking of dreamers, you can dream yourself onto the Punk News podcast by writing us at podcast@punknews.org. This is from Drew K. I know you're probably sick of talking about Bob Dylan because you've mentioned him every episode for the past three episodes, but people should check out his 80s period. Actually, all of his eras have merit. Even the new Rough and Rowdy Waves record was fantastic. But for the 80s, people should listen to Infidels and even Real Live, which, while it was initially dismissed, actually holds up as a unique piece in Dylan's discography. I hope the next bootleg series focuses on that period. Keep talking, Bob. And that's from Drew K.
We're going to talk about Dylan in a bit. So, like, should we just talk about Dylan now, or should we do our mail?
We'll talk about it. This is from Nick C. Here's what Nick C has to say. I want to mention one thing. Anyway, this is from Nick C. Dear Punk News Management, as always, I like that. This is from Nick C. Dear Punk News Management, as always, I am extremely awaiting rewind. As always, I am anxiously awaiting the Christmas special like a little kid waiting on Santa to slide down the chimney. I had a small idea for the special, which might be too late. But anyhow, here goes. A bitter old commenter named Rudolph wants to overturn the top 10 end of the year list because his favorite old punk band didn't make the cut. Might be too late getting to you on the or two on the nose, or just not a good idea. Use it, change it, or lose it. I don't want credit, and you don't have to read this on the podcast. Anyhow, thanks for all you do and helping make this year suck a whole lot less. Thanks, y'all. Happy holidays from Nick. Nick, thank you for writing. And Nick, also, thank you for pointing out that the podcast is not of low quality and is of high quality.
I mean, so we're recording the Christmas special next week, which means in Punk News podcast tradition, John is writing the Christmas special in a few days. So none of us actually know what's on it. So, the prep level will be entirely at the Puck News podcast quality, barometer. So don't misread John's, glowing reviews of what we do. It's going to be slapdash. But the one thing that is good about it is that John asked me earlier, he sent me this kind of sheepish message on the internet. And he said, I'm sitting down thinking about the ideas for this podcast and I have this really goofy concept, and it sort of stars you and are you game? And I'm just like, I'm like, John, I'm on drugs now. I'm good for whatever stupid idea that you have. So let's go. So it's going to happen next week.
I noticed Adam slips in the word stupid, even though I offered him the starring role. Interesting.
John, what's my residuals from this starring role?
Your residuals is you're paying me because you called it stupid. So anyway, and lastly, this is to Jeff. I'm not going to say his last name. This was kind of weird. Out of the blue, I get an email from my lawyer email that says, I'm Jeff. I'm an attorney too. Always nice to run into a fellow lawyer punk rocker. And I was like, oh, wow, nice to meet you. He was a nice guy, and he says he listens to podcasts a lot. So, Jeff, thanks for listening. What did freak me out, though, is that's the first time I've been reached out to as an attorney, and someone's like, I know who you are. You know what I mean? Which kind of freaked me out, because I do try to keep those two things separate. And so I wonder if more people realize the connection than just Jeff, who is also a punk rocker and an attorney. But thanks for reaching out, Jeff, and thanks for listening.
John, I have so many like lawyer questions for you that I can't even process them. As I look at like the bonkers ass news that comes out of your strange little nation every day, there's like four or five things where I'm like, oh, I gotta ask John about that. I'm like, oh, that sounds fucking crazy. I gotta ask John about that one. And then I get to this point and I'm just like, there's been so much crazy that I don't even know which. Like, I can't even unlodge any of those individual questions outside of the fact that, like, is everything super surreal for you right now? Like, as an American, because I'm sure it is, but like as a lawyer, is everything super surreal?
Honestly, like most courts are doing video things, video hearings right now, or video conferences. So at the ground level, law is pretty much the same as it always is, except for it's on video, which they never did before. But I mean, you know, with the Trump campaign, they're filing all these motions and suits, and they're losing every single one. So if anything, to a degree, that reaffirms that the legal process is working like it should. You know, everybody should have the ability to have their claim, even if it's the American legal system, like many other legal systems, if something is too ridiculous, you actually can get sanctioned for it. But that being said, essentially, anyone, if they feel they have a legitimate claim, can bring a legitimate claim and have an attorney look at – I mean, not an attorney, have a court, a judge look it over and determine whether or not it has merit under the eyes of the law. The vast majority of Trump things do not have merit, and the court is striking them down. And, of course, Trump is trying to drum up this big deep state thing, but it's just not happening. And honestly, the less attention we give to it, I think it'll just fizzle out, which – knock on wood, does appear to be happening. The less attention you give this guy, the less power he has. And so, no, if anything, Adam, the fact that Trump keeps getting defeated and the fact that Rudy Giuliani is such a terrible attorney, which really – I would have thought he'd be a good attorney, but he's not. I guess because he hasn't been a practicing attorney in years and years. The fact that this terrible attorney keeps losing and making himself look foolish only reaffirms the core tenets of the Constitution and our fundamental understanding of due process and the law.
But does it change the bar for which you think you could do crazy shit and not get sanctioned for it?
No, if anything, I think judges are actually becoming a little bit more stricter because you watch TV or you watch some of these things and they talk back. For some reason on YouTube, I was watching, it was like court TV or something. And the judge will be like, you know, Mr. Jones, you've been sentenced with DUI. And the guy's like, F you, judge, I didn't do anything. You know, I've never seen anything like that happen in court ever. And maybe it's because I do civil law, not criminal. But if anything, so judges hate cuteness. They detest talk. Like, if you talk back to a judge in civil court, you're getting your ass kicked. You're definitely getting sanctioned or maybe worse, you know. So I've never really seen anyone talk back to a judge ever, you know, like I guess I've seen someone like roll their eyes at a judge, but like that's probably the worst I've ever seen someone do to a judge, you know, because judges really don't take shit. And I think because of this craziness, they're probably even less tolerant for shit, to tell you the truth.
Hmm. All right. You've satisfied my thing for now. I'm going to keep working on this and then prompt you to do something nuts. That's my plan. Just like when we were trying to get Ricky to move from being, you know, someone that we just said was an arsonist to a real arsonist, and I feel like we succeeded. I could work on you.
With Ricky, I'm sure we succeeded. You know, I'm definitely sure our plan there was successful.
I mean, there's a lot of arsons that aren't solved, right?
Right. There's more. I believe more arsons are not solved than that are. And there are many. Look at all the recent fires in California, Adam. Where does Ricky live?
I know.
Coincidence?
M being on this show is probably a bad idea.
all good.
All right.
You can reach the podcast at punknews.org. I'm sorry, Adam. Go ahead.
I was going to say M should play a song because we just dominated that whole opening with a lot of dumb things.
Okay. Well, My Chemical Romance. Did you know they have a song and with Keith Morris?
What?
Surprise! So they have a song and it's called "Hang 'Em High," and Keith Morris is on it. Now, he is, like, very much in the background. And during, I think it's one of the bridges, he has a subliminal storyline going on. And you have to listen really, really hard to, like, hear it. So that's going to be my song. It's "Hang 'Em High" by My Chemical Romance. Ta-da!
Yeah.
Adam, I don't know about you, but M Moore is just, and she's enhanced the podcast already by the 20 degrees. I had no idea that Keith Morris was on a My Chemical Romance CD at all.
Nope. And I'm sure that the totally crappy mono quality that I export these at is really going to help anyone hear that subtle part in the bridge that M alluded to. So sorry people. But oh, okay, I didn't know that. What era of My Chemical Romance? Not that I know the eras, but what year kind of was this? Was this like?
So this is 2004, which is Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge.
So that's earlier, is it not?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
That's their second album.
Huh. That would have been Keith Morris's V2 era when he was doing A&R for V2. So I wonder if it's associated with that.
All right, we'll have Keith back. We should have Keith back and only interview him about that. We won't ask about the Circle Jerks thing at all. We just really delve into the My Chemical Romance cameo. He'd be a fan. All right, so let's talk about some of the news that happened this past week. These are not in the order that I thought they were in. So here we go. All right, first, we talked about the Crass reissues at the start of the show there. So another classic early punk band is having their back catalog given a spit shine and put back out into the world. Bad Brains. So the band has recently reacquired the rights to all of their late 70s and 80s catalog. So they're going to be reissuing the albums and many singles from that period pretty much over the course of all of 2021 up until the spring of 2022. So here is here's the detail. So their debut LP, Rock for Light, in its original mix, and I and I Survive 12-inch single are first in that list there. The Pay to Come single is out on February 2021. The self-titled LP is in April. Oh, sorry, here, I dates are here. I and I Survive is in May. Rock for Light's in June. Quickness in August. The Youth Are Getting Restless, which is a live album recorded in Paradiso, Amsterdam in 1987, is out in October of next year. The Omega Sessions is in January of 2022. Live at the Fillmore, which was a 1982 live album, is out in March or April of 2022. So all those records are coming out via the band's very own label, very own imprint, let's say, which is very creatively titled Bad Brains Records. And it's coming out via Org Music, which Punk News has nothing to do with. So there's a promo video that is sitting on Punk News right now that sort of runs through all those dates and the releases and the order that they're coming out in. But there you go. Bad Brains, famously, John, one of these bands that a lot of their back catalog kind of sounds like ass.
Yeah, you mean mastering wise
No, well, I mean, just they're one of those bands that you go back and you listen to their stuff and just like it infuriates you that it doesn't sound a little bit better. I'm thinking of like, you know, some of like the early Husker Du stuff was all kind of in that boat, and yeah,
well, the big treat here is the Rock for Light remake, or the quote new/old version of Rock for Light. Rock for Light is a very weird album, and they were never really clear its purpose. I'm pretty sure I know what its purpose was. Anyway, Rock for Light is basically a re-recording of the entire first album with a few tracks cut out and a few new tracks put in. But it was mastered and produced by Rick Ocasek of The Cars. And honestly, like, some people like that version better because the production sounds cleaner. But I think most punkers agree that the first album is better than Rock for Light. That being said, Rock for Light still is a pretty awesome album. The weird thing was that when they re-released it in the 90s, they like switched the track order around. They totally remastered it and they remixed the whole thing. And it sounded like muddier and worse and just not that good. So the important thing here is that the version that's being released now is the original Rick Ocasek version, which still is not the very best Bad Brains record, but at least we're getting the original version, which was better than the remixed version. The other stuff, you know, most of the stuff has been pretty much in the printer, easy to get. It's cool that they're re-releasing the I&I 12-inch, and that's because that's got a extended dub version of I&I Survive, which is the only place you can get it. Although a version, I think, might also be on the Greatest Hits album, Band in D.C. But other than that, you know, it's good that the Bad Brains are taking back control of their masters. And this is good and cool. And I will, I'm not going to be getting them all because, honestly, everyone hates to admit it. But a lot the Bad Brains have some pretty mediocre records. You know, I'm not even a huge fan of. Oh, but one other point thing is noticeably the SST first record, not Rock for crap, not House of Suffering. What's the SST one? Eye Against Eye.
Yeah.
That one is not part of this. I'm actually surprised that it isn't. For a very specific legal reason, I'm surprised that it isn't a part of this. And it makes me wonder, well, maybe the Bad Brains aren't quite as together as they think they are, or maybe they are. I don't – I mean, I'm afraid I can't be much more specific than that. But, yeah, I was surprised by that. But I'm glad the Bad Brains are taking control of their masters again. I'm glad they're reissuing it. I will probably be getting some of these. I'm definitely going to wait and see how the first album sounds remastered. Because if you ask me, the most recent one, which is like 2002, sounds pretty good. But a lot of the other stuff does sound like Adam says, like the live album, like it's mixed like crap. You know, Quickness is mixed like crap. You know, those albums definitely could use a remix, remaster, and re-release. And what are you saying? What are you thinking?
Pretty much the same thing. It's good that they have the rights back and everything. So good for them.
John, speaking of rights, there is there's a little artist named Robert Dylan. I've never heard him. I should be referred to as Robert Dylan. So Bob Dylan was in the news recently. He went and sold his entire back catalog to Universal for a cool $300 million. So these are the publishing rights to Bob Dylan's work, as I understand it.
No, that's incorrect. That is not correct. A lot of people were stating that, so you should be forgiven for making that mistake. But publishing rights is a thing that's used in the music industry that doesn't actually have a specific legal meaning. What Bob Dylan – so every song has two associated copyrights. There's the composition right, which is the song as written down, and then there's the sound recording, which is the actual recording of the song, which is a derivative of the composition. So from a legal standpoint, those are the only two rights that we talk about in the legal context. Now – publishing rights are a subset of both the composition rights and the sound recording rights for when things are played on radio or are granted use through other licensing mechanisms. What Bob Dylan did is he didn't just issue his publishing rights, which are a subset of his total bundle of rights. He sold all the rights associated with all his songs from the first album through the most recent Rough and Rowdy Ways. Oh, okay. So, yes, he did sell his publishing rights, but he also sold other rights that are more valuable than just those publishing rights.
So basically, Bob Dylan has sold the farm. He's given pretty much complete control over everything. So Universal Music Publishing is the arm of the Universal, you know, what animal am I thinking? Or octopus, I guess, that has gone and purchased this. Throughout his career, Dylan was pretty famous for maintaining close control over his compositions and sound recordings. And while those things have been licensed out in the past, this is pretty significant. And it's pretty significant in that it's not some subset of the early stuff or anything like that. Like, it's everything up through to and including Rough and Rowdy Ways, which is the record that came out this year. So it does not include future things, but it's basically everything that he was able to sell. Now, as a point of comparison, I went and I dug up some an article that spoke about the news from 5 or 6 years ago about Michael Jackson's stake in the, what was the name of that catalog? What was the actual name of it? It was the
Beatles catalog?
Yeah, the Sony ATV Music Publishing Company. Was that what it was called?
You mean where he asked Paul McCartney what he should invest in, and Paul McCartney said, you should invest in publishing, and then he went out and literally bought Paul McCartney's publishing?
So my dick move ever.
So Michael
Jackson, and then therefore the estate thereof, owned the right to a ton of. So he of course owned the rights to his own music, but that was not included in this particular sale. He owned something like 200 Beatles songs, like Little Richard's Tutti Frutti, like all kinds of really classic things. And that sale was, how much was it here? What was the price tag on it? Oh shit, it was right here in my face. God. $750 million. So Sony went and purchased that chunk of publishing rights that the estate of Michael Jackson had for $750 million. Now, that's a tad more than what Bob has sold all his stuff for, but I'm pretty sure that was a much more sizable library. So these things have moved around at this scale, at least in the past. But I think Dylan's is the first one that we've seen kind of like, you know, crop up in the news in a big way recently. Is there a take on this, John? Is there something we should consider, or is this just sort of like the big music news du jour?
I don't know if there's a hot take. I would say the take on this is that, A, it is surprising that Dylan did this. Dylan was quite smart in that a lot of the musicians, including the Rolling Stones and Beatles, on their first initial run, you know, the first 5 or 6 or 7 years that they were famous, sold away all the rights, and the Rolling Stones still do not have the rights to their music from 62 to 69 at the Abco years, where Dylan sold the rights to his first album, but then he eventually bought it back and kept everything since then. And so he was quite smart in maintaining control of his music. And people always kind of assume that it was not even so much a money thing as it is a dignity thing. You know, like, this is my work. I own my art. You can't pervert my art. So this was quite shocking. And I guess you could say out of character with Bob Dylan. Now, from a financial standpoint, you could say, well, listen, is the Bob Dylan catalog going to go up in value at this point? The answer is no. The older that Bob Dylan gets, the older that his core audience gets. Sure, some college kids probably dig Dylan, but Dylan's fame is only going to decrease in the next 10, 20, 30 years. So now is the time to sell if he's going to sell. And also, of course, every copyright is valueless after the life of the author plus 7 years. So that's still a long ways off, but that's the maximum value a copyright can have. He's already rich, so you would think he might just want to keep that asset for his family to use. It's surprising. I guess he's like, you know what? I just want the cash, and that way I can provide for my family for pretty much eternity, if you will, with $300 million, if you play it right, you know. So I might as well get rid of it. I was surprised, and maybe he didn't want. Honestly, maybe he didn't want his family fighting over it too. Now that I think about it, like maybe that's it. And maybe that's it, isn't it? Could be.
I bet you Bob was just like I am with all the CDs that I collected back in the earlier part of my life. At one point, I look at them and they're just sitting there in my closet, and I go, "What the fuck am I doing with all these?" And then you just try to get rid of them. That's exactly what he's doing.
So you think you are of the same artistic level as Bob Dylan is what you're saying?
Yes, I do. I imagine that part of the real value in this has to be in licensing this stuff out to film and TV and everything like that. Like I don't think so, Adam.
I think Universal could make some
serious money by like moving the songs around that way. Because is that not the only way that money ever happens at this point in music? Is that, you know, your song gets slapped onto the end credits of Grey's Anatomy or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, look at it this way. Like, the right to use a song in a movie for, like, Beyonce is, like, $70,000 to $100,000, roughly speaking. So what's $100,000 divided by $300 million? That's, 3,000? Right?
Maybe they want to make one of those biopics.
Maybe. That's a final thing. I think that's a part of it. I honestly don't think I would suggest investing in music anywhere right now. Although maybe something's going to happen, and while music is free right now, maybe something's going to happen and it will become extremely valuable again. I mean, that is how these things happen, isn't it? People think things are worthless, so they basically get rid of them, and then all of a sudden they're worth tons of money again because the way things have been structured again, you know?
Well, John, I got the perfect opportunity for you then. So there was once a very valuable punk record label, hardcore record label, let's say, post-hardcore. It was called Victory Records, and they they had some very valuable assets in their Chicago area headquarters, and so Victory. We've talked about this a little bit on the show, even though Victory's not really super on our radar. But Victory last year, they sold their catalog and all the associated publishing rights to a company called Concord Music. And then following that, Victory's founder, a guy named Tony Brummel, he went and founded a company called Mission 2 Entertainment. They released the most recent records by the Cro-Mags, and then Insight and Don't Sleep. Well, Victory, the old Victory, is being liquidated, John. And you can get this shit dirt cheap. So they're getting rid of all the physical things that they used to have in this office. And the amusing thing, as for I think for both our listenership and just for like the general people on the internet, is that they aren't just getting rid of these things in some quiet way. They're all have been sort of mass added to this liquidation auction website, and you can go and peruse through, basically like pick over the corpse of Victory Records and kind of get an insight into what that label was like inside of it, at least physically, and get the general vibe of it. You can see the posters that were on the walls. You can see what the break room in the Victory office looked like, because you can buy the fucking fridge. You can buy everything. You can get the office chairs. You can buy gold, plaqued gold records, giant Victory logo signs, plastic boxes of screws for some reason.
That's weird, right?
It is weird. We'll dive into this in a sec. But all of this stuff, hundreds of things, they're all up for auction. And you can really go and see all the physical things that were there. The weird thing about this, and we'll talk about this in a sec, is that certain aspects of the intellectual property of Mission 2 Entertainment, which is the new company, are also up for sale. Specifically, you can bid on the label's logo, customer list, website URL, and the phone number. Like you can get the phone number and, I don't know, use it for your cell phone. So if someone's trying to get a hold of Tony, you can answer it and be like, "I'm Tony," and then scam them. I don't know. I'm not sure what you would need that for. I'm not sure why that's an asset.
How's that different than the other Tony?
No. We're not jumping on Tony Brummel here in his time of need. Okay. So anyway, see, yeah, we are. The associated record contracts aren't part of the sale or anything like that. It appears that Mission 2 is still a going concern or anything like that. So they're not just like selling off that part of it. It's a little bit unclear how Mission 2 operates after selling their own logo and customer list, but I'm not a business person. I'm just the guy in his basement. So anyways, though, there is an auction website. You can find it linked off of punknews.org. It's pretty fascinating. So let's peruse through this thing if we can and see what some of the items are in here. You can get giant light up V's for Victory. There's a lot of like framed posters and pictures of bands that were Victory bands during their heyday, your Boy Sets Fire and Snapcase and Refused and stuff like that. But like right next to those items, you could get their espresso machine. You can get the water cooler.
Their artificial Christmas tree.
Yeah. It was a popcorn machine. Like various couches. Who knows what's happened on those couches, John? Apparently, everyone that worked there had a pro gaming chair that looked like it belonged in a F1 race car. There is some fascinating stuff, and as you get past a lot of the the artistic ephemera and stuff like that, which a lot of it really, to be serious for a moment, tries to carry forward this kind of like tough Chicago, almost sports branding that Victory had back in the day. You get into a lot of things that are in isolation, really, really amusing that they are even up for auction, right? You get to do a lot of the office furniture and desks and stuff like that. But like, you know, old tube TVs that I can't imagine anyone wants anymore. Again, like water, like old printers.
How about the TVs that they put TV not working?
Yeah, like I'm not sure totally what that before. But again, like to get a sense of the culture of the thing, like you can see some of the shots of what the inside of Victory's offices would have looked like on here. So, and like one of the lots of things that they're selling is that they had clocks up on the wall with like the local time zone of Tokyo, London, and Los Angeles up on the wall, things that give this impression that they're like a really high impact sales office and stuff like that, rather than like a punk record label. Like just it's just sort of fascinating to see how I guess how that worked and maybe envision like what the office culture would have been like in this place. But then there's the stuff as you keep going down the list here. That's
APC weird. smart power surge protector, not functional.
Yeah, like so you do get as you go, you get to do a lot of screen printing equipment. So a lot of like you get the, you know, you can see how aside from being just the label, they were, you know, manufacturing and printing a lot of the merch in house for that kind of stuff. So you get that sort of angle on it. But then you just get to random weird shit like the bucket. Like we got to talk about the bucket. Now I'm sure that you just have a, when you liquidate like this, you know, some guy goes in there with a camera and photographs everything and you list everything, because why wouldn't you try to, you know, make money from selling everything that you have, right? But as you really get down there, trying to get to it right now, there is an item in the list here that is literally like a plastic tote, and in the plastic tote is like some screws and some other garbage, and the auction site isn't even really clear what's in there and why, but it's just like tote full of screws, and I'm just blown away that like the low effort that went into making that a saleable item, and I'm gonna find it. Em, what's your read on this while I try to find this box of screws?
It's so weird. Like, I don't understand. I get why, you know, you're getting rid of, like, furniture and equipment that you're not going to use. But then, like, again, like, the non-functional TVs, TV, no remote, just, like, stuff that kind of seems like garbage, you know?
Office
plants. It makes no sense. Oh, yeah, office plants, the rug that's looking like it's had better days.
There's been a lot of times in the past where we in the Punk News universe have poked some fun at Tony's musical kingdom, if only because he invited it, because he created this like larger than life tough guy persona. So you know, it was fun to make fun of things like the Victory Urban Assault vehicle, which was way before your time, but. They owned a Cadillac Escalade at one point that was covered in like Victory stickers or Victory branding. It was like a wrapped car, and they would have like, they drove it around, I guess, when there were shows, and like used it to do promo in front of live shows. But it was introduced onto the internet with this like crazy Photoshop picture of it basically like bursting through a wall of flames or something like that. Like it was amazing. And they called it the Urban Assault Vehicle. And that was just the character of that label for a long time. But here you go. Here it is. Lot 407. Contents of gray. So gray is a gray bucket. To include misc screws, staples, anchors, etc. It is a little box. It is full of like those red Solo cups. In the red Solo cups are various like drywall screws and things like that. And you can't entirely see what's in the box, but it's a thing you could buy.
Brooms too.
Like garbage cans. Yeah, it's crazy. So if you want a piece of Victory Records, you can at least when this, I don't know if this auction's still open, but it doesn't matter. I'm sure there's still garbage cans that you could get. John, what are you buying? Big V?
Well, honestly, the Mission 2 logo has entered, and I actually did want to bid on that, like $50. I'm sure it probably went for more than that, but it'd be funny to say that I bid on that. Have either of you actually been to a real auction ever?
Yep.
Yeah, auctions are actually like really fun, and in-person auction. This is not like an in-person auction due to COVID. Like if this was an in-person auction, like near where I lived, I would definitely go to it. But the weirdest thing is when Victory Records sold their rights to Conquer, Tony's like, oh, I'm going to do Mission 2 Entertainment and it's going to be huge, you know, and now he's selling the logo to Mission 2. So obviously, like Mission 2 is no longer going to be functioning from what we can discern here. So the question was that all like a big ruse so he could like sell it, but then act like he wasn't like quote selling out, and then once everybody kind of forgot about it, then just kind of disappear, or did he think that like listen, I love the Cro-Mags, I am a Cro-Mags maniac, but like Cro-Mags aren't going to sell 100,000 records. Like, did he actually think that the Cro-Mags were going to sell like 100,000 records? You know, and yet again, you know. Harley Flanagan is not the kind of guy you want to piss off. You know what I mean? So I'm stunned by this and I'm confused. And it is extremely Tony Brummel-ish to sell boxes of screws and not working power strips and stuff and all that kind of stuff. The other thing I have is, you know, hardcore, especially like early Victory Records era, like those guys are probably the biggest collectors in music, or if not the biggest collectors in music, the biggest collectors in punk rock. I mean, those kind of guys will drop $500 for a Ratty Tatty T-shirt from 1988 of Youth of Today or something, like literally, you know. And so I wonder, like, were like these super hardcore collectors like bidding on like Tony Brummel's gaming chair? They're like, no, I have to have Tony Brummel's gaming chair. That's $800, $900, $1,000. You know what I mean? I wonder where the level of collectability extends to. And of course, that always brings it back to the amusing thing is like, it's a T-shirt that was worn by like Ray Capo or whatever. But Ray Capo isn't a deity, so what it really is, it's just an old sweaty rag that you just spend $500 for. You know, so two ways of looking at things. I think this is ridiculous and hilarious and weird, and I would like to know what's going on with Mission 2 Entertainment. My guess, it's the end, and I think it was sort of a ruse of Tony to say, I'm still going to do music, and then he decided, why am I doing this? I've got however many million. I don't need to be doing this. That's my take. Ooh, they had unopened banker boxes. I wonder what was in those.
Like,
Adam, we really should have built some of this stuff.
Unassembled banker's boxes or like unopened, like we're not going to tell you what's in there.
I think they are assembled and they're taped, but they're not saying what's in there.
Oh, it's like the recording contract for, what was it, Kesby Nights? It's like that would have cleared everything up if someone would have looked in that box and then poor Catch 22 wouldn't have been embroiled in all of their drama. Well, let's leave Chicago and we'll head to, I don't know what, LA that we're going? I'm not really sure. Where's Gwen?
Orange County, Adam. Orange County.
Yeah, that's her whole brand, right?
The Jesus Tragic Kingdom, Christ. Adam.
Oh, God, it's on the cover. Okay, so Gwen Stefani, of No Doubt, has returned to the world. She has a new single out. It's called Let Me Reintroduce Myself. It is very meta. From a punk news standpoint, it's also pretty reggae influenced in a way that very purposefully calls back to that Tragic Kingdom era of No Doubt and that band's, you know, roots in the third wave ska scene. So right now it's just a digital only single. It's just standalone. There's a lyric video for it that you can find. We've got it linked up on Punk News right now. Now Stefani hasn't had a record out since a Christmas record, I believe, in 2017 called You Make It Feel Like Christmas. The last No Doubt record proper was 2012's Push and Shove. But this is, this is interesting, just because it does harken back to those sort of earlier days. John, what's you get a lot of shit for posting about what Gwen's up to.
I still don't understand why I get like No Doubt was like the ska punk band, you know, or the third wave ska band. Like I truly don't understand like why we get shit about talking about No Doubt or Gwen, but then we'll post something that is like even like no one complains when we post about Dream Car. You know, and I do wonder if it's almost like a sexist thing. Like if Gwen was a man, would people say like, why are you posting about? I mean, would people complain? I don't think they would. I do kind of think it's a sexist thing. You know, honestly, Gwen is awesome, and Gwen's first solo album, "Love Angel Music Baby," is probably the best pop record there is, if you ask me. That's Madonna style pop record. The second and third ones, well, the second one was okay. The third one was kind of boring. The Christmas ones, or whatever. But. For me, No Doubt will always be rooted in punk, and we should always talk about No Doubt in that context. And I'm excited that she's doing music again, and I'm really excited that she's doing reggae stuff again, because I think No Doubt's most reggae album, Rock Steady, is my favorite No Doubt album, and that's the one with the heaviest reggae influence. I thought this track was okay. I enjoyed it. I didn't love it. What it felt like to me is that they linked Gwen up with a whole bunch of studio writers, and they said, okay, we need to write a hit single. And so what you get is, instead of getting an effective, powerful track, you get like a song that sounds like it's got like five hooks. You know, there's so much going on here that nothing is like really super duper catchy. I mean, if you look at Spiderwebs, all Spiderwebs really is, it's the horn line and Gwen saying, I'm walking in Spiderwebs. Like, that's the whole song. And that's why it's a hit, because it's simple and catchy. Here, there's a whole lot going on and nothing really snags. I kind of wish they just hooked Gwen up with, I mean, well, listen, Gwen can write an amazing song on her own. So, I mean, I'd be fine with that. Although she also said she likes writing with writing partners. So I wish they just hooked her up with someone from Jamaica, you know, someone like Chronics, or even someone like Sly and Robbie, who they wrote with, you know, back on the Rocksteady eras, or if they want somebody new, someone like John Nine or somebody, or even somebody, even like Skip Marley, one of the Marley kids. And just say, all right, let's just get a banging reggae track, you know? And they could have just said, here's a simple reggae tune. Gwen Shore's how knows how to write a melody, so you should have Gwen sing a melody over top. Bam, there's your hit. I wish they did that. Instead, it sounds like the record execs thought they knew more about music than people that actually write music. And that's what this track sounds like to me. I think it's good, not great. I'm all for Gwen doing solo stuff. I do wonder what the No Doubt people think. I honestly think there's probably some really bad blood in No Doubt. I don't know that, but the reason I think that is when Gwen did her first solo tour, she didn't do any No Doubt songs, which I thought was kind of cool. But then after it seemed like Gwen kind of wasn't coming back to No Doubt after she did her solo stuff, even though there wasn't a No Doubt album after that, they did that one No Doubt album, Pushing Sub, which actually is pretty good. But Gwen said, I didn't really feel like writing that album, and I felt like pushed into it. And then after that, that's when Dream Car came around, which is everyone in No Doubt without Gwen. And then on her next tour, Gwen started doing No Doubt stuff solo. So I think there might be bad blood in there. I don't know. And Moore, are you a No Doubt fan? Did you dig this track or did you hate it?
I like No Doubt. This felt like it was trying too hard, but it was still kind of fun in parts. And it was so nice not to hear her talk about Blake Shelton too. Just like
true.
But overall, like, I think it's one of those things that's probably gonna grow the more you listen to it, you know, because it didn't, like, the first listen's like, oh, this is kind of, you know, like, what's going on, it's kind of cool, and why are there so many crayons in the video? And then, you know, the second time's like, oh, you know, it's not too bad, it's just fun. So I think that's the way to approach it, but it'd be pretty cool if there's another new No Doubt album for sure.
You bring up an excellent point. So Tragic Kingdom is an amazing album, and one of the reasons it was so effective is because the album is about Tony Kanaal dumping her and her being heartbroken because she thought she was going to marry him. And then the next album, Return to Saturn, is about her meeting Gavin Rosdale. And then on her second solo album, Cool, is about how everything came back around, and she's married to Gavin, but she's still friends with Tony, and everything worked out, and she's happy with her life. And then she gets divorced from Gavin Rosdale. Now she's going out with the country western guy. Like, is it like, so the question is, like, are we sick of hearing about Gwen's relationship, or is that fair for her to write about, because that's what she writes about, and she writes about being human, you know, and these are things that humans deal with. You know, honestly, to tell you the truth, here's my angle, maybe I'm wrong. I was totally down with it all the way up through Cool, where she talked about, like, how everything came back around. It was cool. But it's like, all right, Gwen, you've made your relationship so public so far, and maybe it's because the country western guy seems kind of corny. Like, maybe it was something that I thought was cool. I'd be like, yeah, Gwen, tell us all about the relationship. Maybe that is it. You know what I mean? Like I think the guy's corny. I'm like, all right, Gwen, listen, we've already seen you go through two breakups. You know, I've seen this story before, you know, but I'm not dissing Gwen. I'm a big fan of Gwen, but maybe if I thought the guy was cooler, like maybe it was like Danzig or something, I think it would be awesome. What do you think? Do we want to hear about Gwen's relationships, or are we tired of that?
Oh, I really good. This guy just bothers me. He gets under my skin. Just, ugh.
I think you know what I had to say. I think it's not that we're tired of Gwen thinking about her relationships. We're tired of this relationship.
Yeah.
All right.
And you didn't even comment on that. What do you think of the track?
I think you nailed it.
Do you like No Doubt, Adam?
You know what? I heard Sunday Morning on the radio the other day, and it flashed back to me how much I absolutely love that song and that video by extension. I don't know if that's like an Italian thing, just because it's about spaghetti.
Oh, that video is great, man! Right? But actually, that's not an Italian video, and that's like a South Bay Latino thing. They're doing the lowrider thing.
Yeah, but they're also buying tomato sauce and making spaghetti. Are they not?
Is that Sunday Morning? I believe that's a different video, Adam.
That's Sunday Morning. I can guarantee that's Sunday Morning. In any case, No Doubt was part of my universe back when I was like super into, you know, the kind of the late 90s ska punk thing. I was not their biggest fan.
It is Sunday Morning. You're right, Adam. It is Sunday Morning. What's the one with the working on the car? I thought that was Sunday Morning.
I don't recall what video that is. But I don't know. I never followed her into her pop thing, so although I know a lot of people liked it was just not somewhere that I went, so I don't really have a super huge opinion on that. This again, this is fun from a nostalgia standpoint. It's a little bit too cute, like, you know, she references the bananas line in from that single. It's you know, there's clips of her from the Tragic Kingdom era, visible cutouts kind of throughout the lyric video they put together for this. Like, yeah, it is a little bit written by committee, but I like hearing her playing over at least this genre of music. So, you know, if she goes down that road, it'd be something I'd want to hear. Anyways,
Just a Girl is the one with the working on the car. Just a Girl.
Oh, okay.
My bad.
So let's play a song. Who wants to play something?
Sure, I'll play This is Busy Little Beaver by Crud Is a Cult, and we will talk about Crud Is a Cult when we get back.
Yeah!
All right, we're back. That was Credit to Cult. John, what's the deal?
Credit to Cult rules, man. Credit to Cult. So Philadelphia had this band called Ink and Dagger, which was an amazing Philadelphia band. It's one of these bands that in Philadelphia, everyone's like, yeah, Ink and Dagger. And everyone thinks it's gigantic outside of Philadelphia. And outside of Philadelphia, no one has any idea who Ink and Dagger is.
What was Ink and Dagger, you know, not looped into, like, the was it Buddyhead? Like, were they on that label?
Right, they were the most dangerous band on Buddyhead, and almost certainly the meanest band on Buddyhead. Like Ink and Dagger, quite famously, like, did a lot of mean things. Like, I don't know about criminal things, but mean things. Like not even punk funny, like just straight up mean things, you know. But and that goes back to, you know, what do we do when our favorite artists aren't always nice people? The thing with Ink and Dagger was they dressed up like vampires and they played like Fugazi on acid, and their songs were about being vampires and just like. Really great, like, 90s hardcore, like, post, like, Youth of Today hardcore, and, you know, Fugazi hardcore, but before things got all metalcore, if that makes any sense, but, like, just, like, awesome, hard, weird hardcore. Before they were Ink and Dagger, essentially they were a band called Credit to Cult, and Credit to Cult actually sounds a lot like Ink and Dagger, just a little bit more, I guess, straight-up hardcore and less Fugazi-ish experimentation. And like, almost, like, even in Philadelphia, like, a lot of people don't even know about Credit to Cult. Credit to Cult only ever released one 7-inch and one cassette tape demo. The singer of Ink and Dagger and the singer of Credit to Cult, Sean McCabe, died in 2000. And so this reissue is being put out by the drummer, Alec Rosenberg, on his own label, Toy Box Records, which for a hot minute was a label that a lot of people knew. They put out an Integrity record and some other stuff, like, back at when that stuff was first getting really big. And so the thing to take from this is, in punk rock, there are so many bands that are just completely forgotten that are amazing. And I don't know if Credit to Cult was amazing, but they were excellent. And so I will buy this the second this goes on sale. I am extremely excited for this. It's supposed to have some unreleased tracks, because all they ever put out was the demo and the 7-inch. And so I'm pumped for this, and I'm really excited to hear this when this comes out. And it's a long-lost piece of Philadelphia hardcore, which really should be brought to light.
Very cool. Let's blaze through some of these media stories that we got here, and we'll let people know some things I want to talk about. M, you shared a video from a band called Shame. The song was called Snow Day. What's the deal with these guys?
Well, they have much better songs than Snow Day, but it's an all right song, and their album is coming out soon. I'm not sure exactly when. I'll just pull it up.
January 15th. The record is called Drunk Tank Pink. It's on the Dead Oceans label.
So they sound really cool, and everything they've put out so far off the new album has had like a different direction to it. The first single they put out sounded more punky, and this takes like a different direction, and it's not a bad direction. It sounds kind of cool. And it's another one, like, you'll listen to it and they'll be like, oh, like, this is different. This is, what is this kind of thing? And then the more you listen to it, the more it grows. And the video, the lyric video, has a drone footage from outside of Scotland, which is pretty cool too.
That is linked up right now on Punk News. And another one that you shared was a band that, yes, I've never heard of before, called Punk Crush. They have a song called Corporate America. Who is Punk Rock?
All right. So they are out of Los Angeles. And I found them when I was covering another band on Punk News. And the other band is Susie True. And the guitar player for Susie True is named G. Lombardo, I believe. If I'm saying that correctly.
That's her name now. And
oh, Leonardo, sorry. Yeah, got it wrong. Fixed it. So she has another band called Punk Crush, and they do more of like a punky, garagey sound than Susie True does. Susie True's like, I think they describe themselves as like thrash pop. They're cool too. But Punk Crush has more of a punky, garagey sound, and they sound really cool. So they right now they have one EP out, and it's called Good Luck. It was released last year, and Corporate America is the second track on it, and the video is just fun, and it has tarot cards and like a bait and switch kind of thing. I thought it was really cool, and I really like the song, and I'm really looking forward to hearing more from the band. It looks like they're gearing up to do more next year, so I hope that's the case.
Cool. So you can find that that video, Corporate America. It is linked on Punk News at the moment. John, you want to talk about your boy Moby?
Yeah, he's not my boy. Let's get things straight. So anyways, punk rock karaoke, I think pretty much everyone knows what they are. It's Stanley the Dickies, Greg Henson of Circle Jerks, and Darren Pfeiffer of Goldfinger, and Randy Bradbury of Pennywise. They basically do the music to punk classics. And if you go see them live, you can get up on stage and sing Nervous Breakdown or whatever else you want to sing. But during quarantine, they've had a whole bunch of different people come and sing on them. They've had Blag of the Dwarves. They had Susie of Civet come do some tracks. They had some of Bad Cop do some tracks. They had Sean of War on Women do some tracks, I think. So they recently had Moby do a cover of Iggy and the Stooges' Search and Destroy. And of course, the history of Moby and punk has always been quite fraught, I guess, or confused, because Moby often will say, you know, I was punk rock back in the day, even though I'm famous for my dance music or electronic music. I was punk before all that. I was in Flipper. And Flipper said, no, you weren't ever in Flipper. I think Moby said he played with Bad Brains. Once at Bad Brains, like, you never played with us. And so Moby's got kind of his history. And most recently, well, we'll get to that in one second. I was surprised by a couple of things of this. All the commenters, and that's a good gauge. I mean, we always refer to the commenters and we say, but they're not a good gauge, and they're not a good gauge. But the commenters hated this. I actually thought it was okay. Honestly, it's really, really tough to do Iggy good. And most singers, they overdo Iggy. And so it just sounds like corny, like the 45-year-old dude that wanted to be Iggy but never was. And now he hasn't realized that he's too old to be Iggy, but he's still trying to do it. That's not what Moby does. If anything, Moby slightly underplays it, which works. And I actually thought Moby did a decent job at doing an Iggy track, which is not easy. However, the other thing is – I actually forgot, and this video reminded me that Moby's on everybody's shit list because of some things people have said he has done. But most recently is he said he dated Natalie Portman, and she's like, "We never dated. What are you talking about? We never ever dated." And then he kept saying he should date her, and Natalie Portman got even angrier, which is a weird thing to do. And then actually Moby had to do a public apology where he said, "It's true, I never dated Natalie Portman. I just wanted to be cool." Which was weird. Just I guess the question is, where do we stand with Moby? You know, has Moby served his penance and we can welcome him back in and enjoy him doing Iggy and the Stooges in a decent way? Or should we continue the exile? Also, I noticed he got a whole bunch of neck tattoos, which honestly, I don't think are necessarily becoming, to tell you the truth.
Like you stuck John's style assessment into that. Was Moby properly Me Too'd during that era, or was he just everyone stepped away from him because of his weird weird claims about dating Natalie Portman?
I did too, guys. Yes, I did. But it's where's your picture? She's in Canada right now. Right, Moby. Yeah. I don't think he got Me Too. I'll look that up to see if he got Me Too. I think Natalie Portman was just him sick of saying that he dated her when he did it, which is a weird thing to do.
And there was something with his timeline. He said that he met her when she was 20, but the math doesn't work out. So she would have been 17 or 18 when he dated her.
That's that's certainly... I guess that's not as bad as being, properly called out for being a predator, but it's still somewhere on the weird spectrum. But I don't know. I'm, if it's if that's the extent of his crimes, then I guess, you know, I'm not particularly bothered by it. I wasn't a giant Moby fan in the first place, so I didn't have to grapple with the fact that I wasn't going to be able to listen to, you know, whatever. After that,
the funny thing about Moby is he actually, like, you think of Moby as being like mid to late 90s, but he actually goes back to like 91, which is kind of weird.
I feel like there was a song that I heard the other day, and I was like, oh, I remember this. And then
Adam, can you link Moby back to an earlier story from tonight's podcast?
From tonight's podcast. Okay. So let's see. Was there a Moby Dillon thing? Not that I can call.
And more, can you link Moby back to an earlier story? And this, I'll give you a hint. John owns a Moby 12 inch. Why would John own a Moby 12 inch?
Does it have something to do with Crud is a cult?
No, good guess. No, Gwen Stefani on Moby's giant hit Southside. Gwen Stefani sings.
Was the song that
Southside with Gwen?
It was not. Hold on. I will know it. Oh no, okay. It was the fucking like biggest single. No, I heard Go the other day. Again, I'm listening to all this like 90s mix shit on the internet radio. And it did not occur to me that it was a Moby song, because I think that with the passage of time, I don't know what a Moby song sounds like anymore. It's all sort of like fallen into this like generic 90s electronic music heap, and I don't know what makes them distinctive from each other. And that actually might be that may be like a backhanded compliment. Because there are certain people that released like music during that time where you hear them now and it fucking, of course, sounds like that band. Like, if you hear anything that like was like a big, like who will be like a Moby contemporary at that time? Like Fatboy Slim, right? Like,
yes.
Like if you hear one of those songs, they all have the same fucking like three annoying effects that guy would go back to time and time again in every single song. And like you hear one now and you're just like, oh God, he's going to do this thing where the song like repeats itself like in... And until it goes like, and then there's a, right. You know what I'm talking about? It's fucking annoying. But I don't think like Moby did anything that was like that, like obviously characteristic time and time again. So I don't remember what his shit was at this point, because I'm not mad at it. So I don't know. I thought the vocal effect.
What's the reason you're not a gigantic No Doubt fan? I mean, we always talk about how much you love Ska back in the day. No, were you like, too cool for No Doubt?
I wasn't a gigantic No Doubt fan specifically because, like, in my social circle in high school, which is a very tight little Ska punk social circle, like, No Doubt was claimed. Like my good friend Karen, that is a good friend of mine to this day, like, No Doubt was her band, and she was obsessed with them. And like when a No Doubt thing happened or came up in the news, you know, we'd all turn to Karen and be like, Karen, there's big No Doubt news. And then she'd be super excited about it and you know, would bask in the glow of whatever was happening. And then as the later kind of No Doubt records started to come out and things got maybe a little bit less, like a little bit more long in the tooth, a little bit less like, you know, instantly exciting, you know, we would sense Karen's disappointment happening. And we would, you know, commiserate with her about the fact that her band was now doing something that she wasn't quite a fan of. And like, there was just this sense that like we all had our little bands that we were obsessed with and talked about and stuff like that. And like, No Doubt was Karen's band. And yeah, that was just, I don't know. That was just the way that operated for some reason.
No Doubt is so good, Adam. You right? Am I correct?
I'm not doubting it.
Am I correct that No Doubt is amazing?
Yes. 100%.
See, Adam?
I'm not doubting it. All right, fine. Whatever.
Why do you hate No Doubt? It's so good.
Okay, so are there any more stories that we need to talk about? I'm not looking at my notes anymore. Okay, the last one. So John Loves Moby. That's where we left things off with. Okay, so here is here's a song that we can end things with. So a podcast at punknews.org is how any of you can email us. If you do email us, it's going to take a couple weeks before you hear back from us, because next week I think we're recording a Christmas episode, although you know, whenever we record a special episode, we always end up doing two. So maybe we'll end up doing two episodes next week, John. I don't know. So in any case, email us podcastdebunkings.org. That's how you do it. Here you go. Priors. So I love Priors. I love all the people in Priors. They all do amazing and lovely things. This year, as they were kind of like stuck in isolation, Chance Hutchinson, the singer, he's married to Jackie, who is the lead singer of the Pale Lips. So Chance and Jackie have basically been like holed up in their house in Montreal, and they started just making these crazy records as a band called Chance and Jackie that sounds like this great amalgamation of those two bands together. Drew Demers, who's the drummer in Priors, he has this art label called Pentagon Black that he co-runs, and they put out lots of cool stuff sort of over the course of the pandemic. And then Max, who else there? Maxime Descharmes, who plays in the band. He has a crazy Devocore thing called New Vogue. So they've all been doing cool stuff, but Priors themselves have been sitting on a full length for the whole course of the year. And I think originally it was supposed to come out on Slovenly, like way back in, you know, probably like March or April or something like that. But then COVID happened and everything went crazy, and they sat on it for a while and they didn't know what to do with it. So it is finally going to see the light of day. The record is called My Punishment on Earth. It's coming out not on Slovenly, but by a new label that started up out of Brussels, which is called Drink and Drive Records. There's 10 songs on this thing. The cover art is like super gnarly. It's very appropriate for 2020. There's a hand with a big mean looking syringe in it. There's a crazy Rasputin looking priest. All kinds of great stuff that's on there. It's really good, fun, buzzy garage punk that has a pretty heavy synth element that's sort of been introduced into it. So the first single to come off this record is called Kick It, and we're going to play Kick It, and it's from the new Priors record, and Priors is good. Here you go.